And I'm beginning to think we may just be turning it around with all the great green pioneers working their you-know-whats off for all these years. We are finally starting to see some results, some action, some mainstream media coverage of exotic things like electric cars in the form of the Chevrolet Volt. And with all the news about President Obama visiting the place where they're going to be making the next generation of electric vehicles, the Chevy Volt, of course, in Detroit, a place that would otherwise be a dying factory. Well, I just had to think of Chelsea Sexton. Do you know that name? You should. She is one of my sheroes, and she was also the narrator and heroine of the great documentary Who Killed the Electric Car, and I think about her often when I see coverage of the resurgence of the electric vehicle and decided it's time to have her back on the program. She was on Eco Talk when it was on Air America and when they were staging a protest outside of GM's headquarters down in Southern California while they were rounding up the EV1s, and in the dark of night, as I've recounted the story, shipping or trucking them off to Mesa, Arizona, and crushing those electric vehicles, saving one or two for the museum. So it is with great pleasure and excitement that I welcome Chelsea Sexton to the Green Front. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined by another one of my favorite guests, and that is Joseph Rome. He does the fabulous Climate Progress blog at climateprogress.org. And he is going to be joining us. He's a friend of Chelsea's, talking about how the media has been covering the debut of the Chevrolet Volt and also about the fires raging in Russia and the flood, record flooding in Pakistan, and if that is not what climate change would look like if it were here, actually arrived on this planet, I don't know what we would expect to see. So we're going to tie all those strings together, connect all those dots. But first of all, welcome Chelsea to the program. Great to have you.
Great to be back. It's been a while.
Yeah, you've been busy, I'm sure, the last few years. I'm sorry we haven't been in direct touch, but I certainly have been following the effort to resurrect and reincarnate the late, great electric car. And you were really at the forefront of that movement and had just a wonderful story to tell. So if you wouldn't mind starting, Chelsea, with just recounting your experiences at GM, how you came to be in the forefront, sort of an accidental activist here and heroine of this story. It's just a great story how you met your husband there on the job and you were taking names for a waiting list for the EV1 when all of a sudden, out of the blue, it was canceled for lack of demand. I'm paraphrasing, so
yes,
let's hear it in your voice and your words, because it is a real snapshot of that moment in history, and thank goodness it is history.
Yeah, well, yes, and happily we have something to talk about. No, it's been accidental for sure and a bit of an adventure. I started working for General Motors back when I was 17, mostly as a way to pay for college. I was sort of very self-sufficient, still am, and found along the way that I really liked cars, and specifically the electric car, and I moved over to the EV1 program. We started putting them on the road. I think all of the automakers who at the time were forced to build electric cars by the state of California thought they'd go out and they'd put on a good show, but no one would really want them. And it turned out that everybody loved them. And not only did they love them, they wanted to keep them and they wanted more built and we had waiting lists and all sorts of things. And so relatively stunned, I think, by the public reaction, the automakers kind of went, oh, dear God, we don't really want to be a part of this technology right now. And they started reclaiming the different vehicles and crushing them. And for the longest time, we thought, this is just the most bizarre story. Even if you think we're the crazy ones, where's 60 Minutes, Frontline, or somebody to tell this really interesting story? And just nobody would do it. And as these programs were ending, as some of the drivers and a couple of the employees and various folks thought, we just can't let this go by unnoticed. And so we got together and we did goofy things like putting on a funeral for the car. And eventually we got to the point of having these vigils of sort of sitting outside where the cars were being kept, in EV1's case in Burbank, for a month, 24 hours a day, sort of guarding these vehicles. And eventually, you know, GM stepped in and took the cars away and did end up crushing them, but not before we brought a tremendous amount of media attention to the story. And in the end, Chris Payne, one of the drivers, ended up making a little movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? And we thought we'd burn copies for our parents and move on with our lives. And lo and behold, it's gotten a little bit bigger than that, so much so that we're making a sequel now, Revenge of the Electric Car, because in the last few years, every automaker wants to make a plug-in car again. It's sort of like the moment has finally come, and we are now months, not years, but months away from having electric cars in major OEM showrooms again.
It is amazing, and I love the name, Revenge of the... I knew you were making a sequel. I didn't know the name of it, and that's just so perfect. It's so American,
well, once
you
make a murder mystery, you got to go monster movie next, right?
Yeah, I mean, there must be so many moments where this has been surreal, because I feel that, and you were really, you know, in the forefront, much more directly involved, but just watching this whole thing evolve, or first devolve and then re-evolve, and I can't help but wonder, and have said out loud many times, why did they have to kill it to resurrect it? You know, what's up with that? And obviously that film really played a key role, but it seems that it was a little bit ahead of its time, but not really, because I'm sure you recall I was, you know, covering that
yep.
protest, and at the same time, was it Hurricane Rita, I think, was slamming into Galveston, Texas, when you guys were, I think, holding your vigil, and there were all these large stranded SUVs on the shoulder of the road, like
mm-hmm.
so many old big dying dinosaurs. And they couldn't get out of town fast enough because all the gas stations had run out of fuel. This is while the storm was knocking some oil rigs off their platform, sounding all too familiar today.
Yeah.
And I thought, how ironic that they're rounding up electric cars, killing them off, while cars are dying because they don't have enough fuel to get out of town to get away from what's probably a globally warmed infused storm hitting the shores. It just was, you know, too surreal. So I'm so glad you made a movie about it to try to capture the absurdity, the irony. And, of course, now there's another story to tell, a much happier one. But I just want to get your overall thoughts on what a long, strange trip it's been.
It really has been. And, you know, on one hand, of course, they didn't have to kill them to bring them back. And it's an unfortunate aspect that it took 10 years to get back to where they all left off. You know, GM was talking about building a plug-in hybrid as the sequel to the EV1 way back then. So the irony of the Volt is not lost on many of us from that generation. At the same time, there is definitely the aspect of how long are you going to mire yourself in that? And, you know, maybe it's better to look forward and to worry about what's going on today, because we're not going to change what happened. It's a really interesting story. I think we did our part for that. We made sure it didn't go by unnoticed. And I think in the process, you know, the act of killing it got so many people pissed off and probably aware and caring about this that may never have happened. So it, in a strange way, it brought a lot more attention than might otherwise have happened toward this technology. And there are a lot of other ironies. You know, we were getting emails. Forget the price of gas, which everyone focuses on. We can't get our hands on this stuff, but we have electricity. Can you send us electric cars? So for a variety of reasons, and another example has been going on for several months now, relying on any one fuel leaves us vulnerable as a country, regardless of the price or availability of that fuel. So that's just one of many aspects. You know, rising gas prices over the last couple of years has been another one. Although, as I run around the country, I find that people aren't so concerned about the price of gas going up again. It's the volatility that they're scared of. And they like the idea of plugging it at home because they can do it easily and cheaply and consistently and daily and be full every day when they leave the house and never have to worry about it again, what happens to the price of gas next week. And that's before even getting into the 30,000-foot issues like climate change and energy security and all these other things that we worry about, particularly on the coasts. So I think it has been a confluence of events that have almost conspired in a strange way to bring this back. And we're happy to have a hopefully better story to tell this time. But I think, you know, all of this also goes to the fact that we as consumers have to take responsibility to be smarter ourselves and to ask more questions and to vote politically, but also with our wallets, and not let something like this ever happen again.
And that's so terrific that you identified the consumer as one of the culprits in, you know, who killed the electric car, because, you know, that has been kind of the missing piece in part is, you know, an educated populace that demands greener cars and programs and politicians and products. You know, it really has to happen at the demand level in order to, well, the supply and demand. But we started a little campaign called Don't Be Fueled, Mothers for Clean and Safe Vehicles, back in 2002, trying to address that very gap, to educate soccer moms, if you will, about the need for cleaner, greener, more fuel-efficient vehicles, family-friendly as well. At the same time, petition Detroit, the big three, to provide a hybrid minivan, which I still don't think we have, by the way. Maybe an electric minivan is coming. Do you know?
Well, Chrysler had been working on a plug-in hybrid minivan, but I think most of their electric vehicle plans have been scrapped in the wake of their own bankruptcy issues and purchased by Fiat.
And that is one of the ironies. There's so many directions I want to go with, and I'm so glad you're with us for the whole hour because there's so much to talk about since we last met on air. And that is, you know, remember W talking about how we couldn't improve CAFE standards and, you know, the Congress, that's what began our campaign, what triggered it, what launched it was when John Kerry and John McCain, in the wake of 9/11, so this was March 2002, you probably remember this, the Senate voted against, you know, raising CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy standards, and they said it would cost jobs and hurt the economy. You know, I mean, Bush was puppeting that, and it was, you know, all the way down to Debbie Stabenow voting against it. And, you know, they said, soccer moms want their large SUVs. And we thought, no, we don't. We want them to be much more friendly to the environment and to our pocketbooks. You don't speak for us. And we just thought that was outrageous. So sure enough, they didn't do anything to improve CAFE standards. And what happened to Detroit? I think we lost a few jobs. I think we hurt the economy. I think we bailed out GM.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, look, the whole industry has been suffering. And I think that ironically played a part in them coming around. They were sort of dying. I mean, there's
no
other way
to put
it.
Brought to their knees.
And realize that they have to start building different things in order to, you know, compete not only with other countries, but to survive as companies at all. Not everybody wants an SUV, and not everybody wants a car that runs on gasoline. You know, we hear a lot about electric cars aren't the cars for everybody. No, they're not. Neither is there a single gas car on the road today that's the car for everybody. This has always been about providing more variety and providing choice so that the people who want to go this direction can. And hopefully it becomes a rolling snowball that sort of gathers some momentum and we pull more and more people along every time. But until we start building some cars, none of it's going to matter.
That's right. Let's just go back to that moment, I think about a year and a half ago, when the executives from the Big Three were flying in on their corporate jets, not carpooling, by the way, or the air equivalent, but their own corporate jets. And, you know, they were Rick, forgot his last name right now, but you'll remember him.
Wagner.
Yes, thank you, Rick Wagner, you know, in the hot seat. And I happened to run into your friend Dave Bartmus of GM at Hollywood Goes Green conference in L.A. It was December. It was that very week, the very day that the testimony was taking place. And I kind of expressed surprise that he was at this conference and not there, you know, Congress. You know, I'm staying away from there, Capitol Hill. And I said, so tell me, Dave, did you ever let your, you know, superiors and colleagues know at GM that, you know, we moms were demanding cleaner cars and that, you know, by spending millions of dollars to defeat, you know, clean air legislation in California, AB 32, and by promoting the Hummer, you're not exactly, you know, winning customers and showing your green side. In fact, you're greenwashing. And he said, yes, I did pass that along to Rick Wagner in particular. I said, and what did he say? This was a conversation that we mothers, you know, with the Gasroots campaign, Don't Be Fueled, had met with Dave Bartmus in 2003. What did he say? What did they say, Dave? And he said, they said, stop drinking the Kool-Aid, or stop drinking the water. You've been drinking the California water too long. In other words, we had brainwashed him into thinking that, you know, family-friendly, fuel-efficient cars would be something that would help GM and that would be something that would actually be wanted by, you know, mainstream moms.
Oh, well, the funny thing, of course, is that now Dave must have been sort of bathing in that Kool-Aid because he and GM in general are both so much on board with plug-in cars now and with more fuel-efficient vehicles and could not be. They're one of the more aggressive automakers now. It's the strangest thing, but the Chevy Volt will hit showrooms in December, and GM and Nissan are the two most aggressive automakers in the space.
And GM is going to boost their output of the Volt, and there is demand. There are actual waiting lists, which will not surprise you. I guess the surprise is that they're actually meeting demand this time around. But for all the reasons you've just enumerated, and strange as that is, it really took them looking like, you know, the dinosaurs that they were acting like, not going proudly into the future or boldly into the future, but by using the first excuse to not, you know, have to make electric vehicles and blaming it on lack of consumer demand when, again, you had the waiting list, you know, on a clipboard in your own hands.
Yep. Yeah. And it's been good to see them respond better this time. And the reality is the Volt is a really good car. I mean, we were all a little worried when GM said they were stepping back into the plug-in space and sort of that, yeah, great, but fool me once, fool me twice kind of thing. And will they make a good one? And you know, over the last couple of years, that has become a really good car, and it's really fun to drive. So I think folks will be happy with it.
And, you know, fast forward to the news the other night when there was a woman at the, you know, Hamtramck facility there in Detroit saying green cars, you know, that's our salvation. That's our future. This is saving our plant. This is saving our little town here. And it was kind of a green dream, you know, for those of us who have been saying this for so many years. This is the part of the way out of the recession. This is, you know, part of the way out of Detroit slump. You know, retool and coming up with new technology will increase jobs, will grow the demand for, you know, skilled personnel. We just have to retrain them, not, you know, shut down the auto industry.
Right.
So good news, really. And what do you think of the price? Do you think that that's going to be available with the tax rebate to many Americans on the Volt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that on one hand, you know, the price has been an interesting subject. It got a bit of, got a lot of negative press since this announcement last week. You know, GM finally announced that the Volt was going to cost $41,000 MSRP. There's a $7,500 federal tax rebate that brings it down to about $33,000, which is actually for early entrant electric cars about or maybe even a little better than we expected. You know, and on some level, the Nissan Leaf came in so much cheaper that I think all of us were sort of hoping for a Hail Mary from GM, and I think that a lot of the negative press has really been sort of disappointment that festered, because at $41,000, it's what GM has been saying for years the car was going to cost. So it was no big news at all. Where they really knocked it out of the park, though, was with the Leaf. The Leaf is $350, which is, you know, about the price of something, you know, half that MSRP for a regular car. So it really is a nice entry for more people than the MSRP might have been available to. And it's nice, too, because we will see improvements in the second generation and so on of both the Volt and the Leaf and the other EVs. So this gives people a chance to try out the technology but not feel like they bought the first ever computer and that something better is just around the corner. So with so many different electric cars, you know, there were 40-some-odd that were shown at the Frankfurt Auto Show last year. With so many different cars coming, there will be a lot of choice. And folks that don't want to get locked into one thing will really find the lease scenario appealing, which is funny because leasing was awful for the last generation of electric cars, but it will be one of the enabling factors for this one.
And what about, you know, the infrastructure this time around? Will there be more places where people can plug in if they're not home or they're not at work, where they may have a place to plug in, charge while they're at work?
Yeah, the nice thing is that a lot of the infrastructure we deployed in the 90s is still there. It needs to be retrofitted because we finally have every automaker using one connector standard, so any car can use any charger, and that's a huge thing in and of itself. We'll retrofit those, and then we'll add some more. So there will be infrastructure out there, but at the same time, we fully expect the first couple of years of buyers will mostly have garages, not all, but most, and be able to charge at home. And then the other nice thing about something like the Chevy Volt or the plug-in Prius that's coming, some of the plug-in hybrid-type vehicles, is they're not dependent on public infrastructure, because at the end of the day, you can always put gas in them in a pinch, and you can always keep on going that way, and you can drive them for days on end as gas cars if you really, really have to. And so the folks that are really nervous about the infrastructure piece will have some other choices this time around, and yet we have a lot of great 100-mile pure electric cars coming as well, and some a little more than that, but we have more companies that are aiming to try to be economical in their pricing, so they're aiming at about 100 miles, and that's a great commuting choice day in, day out for people that can charge at home.
And what about those environmentally concerned folks who are concerned about, you know, more demand on electricity, that, you know, this is going to be actually contributing to greenhouse gas emissions because it's mostly coal-fired power plants that will be, you know, providing the energy to charge these electric vehicles?
Yeah, we've certainly been hearing that for years, and many more studies have been done. EPRI, Electric Power Research Institute, is probably the most reputable, broadest-looking study, and have analyzed not only sort of the nationwide grid but individual locations, and found that the worst-case scenario, if you're sort of 100% coal, at worst you're no worse than a clean gas car. And that's excluding any other reasons that you'd want to drive an electric car. But nationally, the plug-in portion of an EV is about twice as clean as a gas car. So that's the worst case. And obviously, the grid gets cleaner over time. And people can get solar or wind and other available renewables either individually or through their utility companies. So we're certainly trying to improve that scenario, but we're at a good enough place to start, and certainly no justification for delaying the deployment of vehicles. The other neat thing is that we have a lot of excess grid capacity. You know, we have the current capacity to charge 180 million plug-in vehicles with no new power plants of any kind, because most vehicles charge at night. And so certainly we want to encourage that behavior, but it kind of happens anyway, because that's when the cars are sitting around and you're sleeping or doing something else. So it coincides with natural lifestyle. So we don't have to build any new power plants of any kind, and certainly I've never heard an electric vehicle advocate want another coal plant. So that's off the table. To the extent that we're going to build anything, we want it to be renewable, but we're not going to have to build anything for cars for quite some time.
Good. And the other concerns I hear are health concerns. Some people are concerned that the lithium-ion batteries might, you know, not be so good to be in close proximity to when you're driving a car with a powerful battery. What's your sense of that risk, if any? Exposure.
Mostly what we hear about in that regard is EMF exposure,
right.
And we've been hearing that for years. It's not a lithium thing. It's just if you put a big motor in batteries in car, people worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the automakers, because of that concern, have always paid an abundance of attention to things like that and have really insulated these various components such that we actually find you get more exposure from a microwave and a hairdryer and a lot of the common everyday things we don't even think about. Otherwise, with batteries, people worry about fires a little bit because of the laptop fires of some years ago, and we've actually found that using slightly different chemistries alleviates that problem quite a bit, as does the thermal management of the vehicle itself. And we tend to forget that we drive around 12 to 20 gallon bombs every day. So a little bit just perspective, you know, stuff will happen, but in general, gasoline is a lot more combustible than any kind of batteries. And the last thing is recycling, will we recycle them? So we figured out battery recycling when we started putting one in every car on the road today. Lithium batteries are recyclable, nickel metal hydride batteries from hybrids are recyclable, and, you know, the foregone conclusion is that we will continue to recycle batteries. There's nobody that sort of accepts we would put them in landfills. So the disposable AAs and different things that we use are actually a far bigger environmental problem than any vehicle batteries.
It almost seems like an urban myth when I actually travel outside of, you know, the Green Bay area, and people find out on my fourth Prius, I keep leasing them, you know, as the technology improves. And they say, aren't you concerned about, you know, either the health effects or that the battery is going to die and you're going to have to pay to replace it, you know, after so many years? I say
right.
No, because they've been, first of all, they've been in operation in Japan, the Prius in particular, for many more years. What is being done to either prolong the lifespan of the battery before it is safely disposed of, and just to dispel, you know, some of these myths that they're going to have to be replaced after just a couple of years, and the consumer is going to have to spend, you know, tons of money to replace them?
Well, the first answer to the consumer piece is that manufacturers have to warranty these things. So far we're seeing 8 years battery warranty for both the Volt and the Nissan Leaf. Some of the other plug-in Prius and different things will actually have to have at least a 10-year warranty per the state of California. So in no case are we talking about you have to replace anything within a couple of years. And should anything happen in those 8 or 10 years, it's the automaker's responsibility. So given that liability for them, they're really, really concerned with making sure these batteries last a very long time and have been doing incredibly robust testing to ensure that. The other aspect is that even when a battery is no longer suitable for a vehicle, it still has 60, 80, sometimes more percent of energy left in the battery. And so we're really looking at second or even third uses for these batteries after they come out of cars, where they could really be used for things like grid storage for renewables and other uses before they're finally recycled. And, you know, the neat thing about that, besides the obvious environmental impacts of just extending life and reusing, is the economics. There's potential for amortizing the cost of batteries over two or three uses. So you can imagine if Southern California Edison, for example, had a guaranteed deal to buy used Volt batteries, and GM knew they could count on that, they could reduce the price of the Volts up front, knowing they have this guaranteed sale. So there's other business models that might eventually come into play on some of this stuff, you know, once we look at how long these batteries are really lasting in real-world applications and really residual values, the big bogey that everyone's trying to assess right now, because you can't do advanced purchase agreements if you don't know how much the thing will be worth.
Right. Has GM approached you about taking a new job, selling the Volt, taking names, running the waiting list?
No, it's funny. I actually talk to GM quite a bit, and certainly they'll be included in our next film. They're much more interested in this one for some reason. But no, we've had no discussions about actually working for them.
And I imagine the film probably keeps getting extended because there's so much happening right now on the electric car front. It's probably hard to wrap up the sequel. Can't quite do that yet.
That's true, and we certainly have in mind sort of, you know, we realize this is a chapter in the overall story, and so we're really kind of chronicling a lot of the human interest efforts to bring them back. Can a company like GM save itself with programs like the Volt? Can a smaller company like Tesla really succeed in the automotive industry with the big boys? You know, they had their first IPO since Ford a few weeks back, so they have a big hurdle to clear. And then we have some sort of some characters, some, you know, mad scientists and different people that have been provocative in their own way. So really this chapter is, do they come back and how does that happen? And ideally it ends with cars rolling off a production line later this year, but we'll have to wait and see.
And I guess the key factor, it seems, is the old, you know, American competition is kicking in, you know, that competitive spirit, as we're seeing, you know, so many players now entering the field. That can only be a good thing. For the environment, for the consumer.
And I think we're seeing international competition. We're seeing fear of China eating our lunch and India and places like that. We're seeing a lot of geographic competition. Countries are stepping on themselves to announce the latest and greatest electric vehicle goal. You know, 1 million cars by 2015, no, 10% by 2020, and all these different things going on. So it has definitely sort of stoked our American competitive spirit, but it's really international now.
And isn't it nice to see that old American ingenuity and innovation, you know, really apply here in the green sector? And hasn't it been kind of odd for those of us who've been wondering, where is that? You know, why is that not applying in this case? And suddenly it seems like it is kicking into gear, so to speak.
It's fantastic to see, and it is so fun to have automotive employees come up to me and say, you know, I'm so happy to finally be working on something cool again.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so, there's an article in the New York Times today, a bet on clean energy in the automotive state, just the potential, you know, for new battery plants and new jobs, you know, to make these vehicles. It's a genuine reason for optimism amidst so much despair. We have gotten halfway through the program and haven't really talked about the little oil spill in the Gulf, which, of course, is no spill. It's a killing everything in sight, or at least when it was gushing, and who knows the long-term effects, and there's plenty of short-term impact on the tourism industry, fishing industry, those who make their livelihoods along the coast. But that certainly should go a long way towards fueling demand for vehicles that do not require oil to run.
Absolutely.
Do you think it has been kind of a perfect storm? I mean, we had the explosion in the coal plant, don't forget, in April, right before the end of April, tragic explosion on the Deepwater Horizon. And then we've had this, 105-day, you know, situation. I guess it's maybe not still spilling, but it's still certainly, and for years to come, going to be a problem, what has spilled. And what is it, over 200 million gallons? Is that what it is? It's up there. And then we also have, you know, gas prices, I guess, are somewhat stable at the moment. But as perhaps the war in Iraq is winding down and we're seeing, you know, the huge toll that that has taken on, you know, our nation, on our, you know, deficit. If this isn't a perfect storm, Chelsea, I don't know what we need to kind of wake us up and to smell the CO2.
I think that's absolutely true. I all of these things, what they've done is raise awareness, and I think brought it closer to home, made it more tangible, because, you know, what I found in a lot of the discussions about climate change and stuff is it's really hard for people to relate to. It's something that's way out there, and it'll happen sometime, you know, our kids and grandkids, and it's hard to see in your everyday life. What does it mean to me is really tough for the consumer. And so this has brought all of that home and really raised awareness in that regard. The flip side of that, though, is the thing we've always heard most often running around with our first movie is, I didn't know electric cars were possible. And we get automakers who for years had said, well, people don't want electric cars because we're not getting them asking for them by the millions. And people can't ask for what they don't know is possible. So the analogy I use is like, you know, we should have looked at the Walkman 20 years ago and asked for an iPod. You know, how do you know that? So what our mission is now is really raising awareness on what is possible and marrying those two things together, because people can want to change. You know, people will have been wanting to change for some time, but if they have no options, nothing's going to happen. So
exactly.
It's a matter of marrying the awareness and the need with, here's what you can actually do, and here's the one choice you can make that will impact all of these things. And, you know, it's nice to have something so tangible and so impactful as one vehicle choice.
And it's so nice to be out of Yes, and to be out of the talking mode and into the, you know, actual production, you know, assembly lines.
Right.
Taking place right now.
Point to.
Yes.
You can do this.
And, yes.
And you don't have to give anything up.
We're going to point to a quick break here, and then when we come back, our friend and your friend, Joseph Rome, of Climate Progress and the Center for American Progress, is going to be with us talking about not only the Chevy Volt, but also raging floods and raging fires, and oh my, could this be climate change arrived on the planet? We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Green Front Radio. I'm Betsy Rosenberg.